Okay. Good morning, everybody. We'll proceed with our next case, which is case number 79137. We have Messi versus Messi. Okay, we have Ms. Glantz representing the appellants. Ms. Can you help me pronunciation counsel on your last name? I'm sorry, I don't want to mispronounce it.
Good morning, Justice Gibbons. It is Ginkanko.
Okay, Ginkanko representing the respondent. And Ms. Glantz, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Okay, very well. We'll reserve 5 minutes, and we'll kind of remind you, I assume you both can see the clock on the video, and then Justices Silver and Gibbons are in Las Vegas. Justice Stiglitz is at her home in Reno by video, so we're all attending. So, Ms. Glantz, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Glantz. With me here today, masked up and 6 feet away, is Dennis Kennedy. And we represent the appellant, Mr. Eric Messi, in this matter. Eric is before you today because the district court in this case deprived him of one of the most fundamental guarantees of our legal system, due process. In fact, the district court deprived him of this guarantee in more than one way. By first, dismissing his petition for divorce without giving him adequate notice or a meaningful opportunity to be heard. And second, by dismissing it based on a prejudicial ex parte communication. Now, I presume that my colleague counsel for Vanessa Messi is going to come before you and argue that this was harmless error. And I will address why it is not after she makes that argument.
But Ms. Glantz, before we start the kind of meat of this, quick question. Is this case moot? Has anything happened in California? Has there been a judgment? Like, where are we in the case? Because it's been about a year. Sorry. But I'm just trying to figure out where we are, if this is something we're going to end up deciding or not.
Right. As it stands, this case is not moot. I had checked to make sure that a divorce had not been effectuated in California as of the date of this argument. And as far as I'm aware, there has not been a divorce in California. So with that, either one of these missteps as it stands is an independent basis for reversal by this court. And that is what Mr. Messi asked this court to do today, to reverse the decision of the district court and remand this matter for a proper hearing so that Mr. Messi might be heard on the potential dismissal of his case and so that he may have an opportunity to address the prejudicial ex parte communication. So turning to the first of these, the opportunity to be heard and notice of such opportunity, neither of which Eric received here. An elementary and fundamental requirement of due process is that notice reasonably calculated under the circumstances be given to an interested party to afford them the opportunity to present their objections.
Ms. Kennedy, I have a question. Ms. Quinn, Kennedy, hi, Justice Silver. My question, and I'm just remembering from a case that I had in the Court of Appeals, that this is a very common practice in the Eighth as far as the family courts calling other jurisdictions. Is there some kind of local rule that you're aware of regarding this practice where they call another judge to get an update? I mean, this happens where cases are filed simultaneously, and this is not the first time I've seen this.
Right. So the district court in this case in the final order categorized this as a UCC-JEA conference. And the UCC-JEA, when there's child custody at issue, allows jurisdictions to speak with each other. The problem here is that there's no children at issue in this divorce. Rather, the district court simply categorized it as a UCC-JEA. But what's also important is that the UCC-JEA also provides that when district courts speak to each other, that conversation be disclosed to the parties and that the parties be afforded an opportunity to address whatever was discussed. So even if the district court had operated under the assumption of the UCC-JEA, the district court still would have been required to disclose this to the parties before outright dismissal of the case. And so on that topic, I'll go ahead and move forward to the ex parte communication here. When a party is prejudiced by an ex parte communication, the court has infringed upon that party's due process rights. And there are some factors that the Ninth Circuit uses to determine whether or not a communication is considered prejudicial. And I'll go ahead and address each of those factors as they pertain to this case in turn. So the first of these is to consider the purpose for the communication or the reason or justification that this communication excluded the parties. So here the district court did not state outright its reasoning for addressing the California court. In the memorandum that the district court sent to Mr. Messi advising him that it would schedule a telephone conference. It stated that it was going to do that to, quote, properly address the matter. And when looking at the record, it seems that the district court initially was trying to confirm some of those procedural details of that California case. The issue here is that Vanessa had filed a declaration to inform the court where she had also indicated that the record in full from the California proceeding would be forthcoming. She'd had some issues with e-filing, so she had to mail it, and the court clerk advised her that that could take up to 3 weeks. So if the purpose for this communication here was to confirm those details, the district court could have waited for that record instead of just contacting the California court. But even if the district court did want to speak with the California court directly, there was no reason or justification for excluding the parties. The district court here didn't even attempt to involve the parties in this conversation. Rather, the district court had sent a memorandum to Mr. Messi advising him that it would schedule this telephone conference. It didn't advise him as to a date or that he had the opportunity to be present during it, just that it would schedule it and advise him not to do anything further in the case until the matter had been addressed.
Ms. Glantz, if I may, I'm sorry. There's a little delay, so I apologize. Would you characterize this telephone call as purely a procedural update or as a substantive conversation about facts outside of the record? Like, how would you, if you had to pigeonhole this conversation, certainly a judge can call another judge and find out what the next court date is or things along those lines. Do you feel that this conversation, you know, strayed into other areas that made it extra inappropriate?
Absolutely. As an aside, just initially, I think it's important to note here that the Nevada Code of Judicial Conduct still requires procedural communication be disclosed to litigants and that they have the opportunity to respond to those before the judge does anything with the case. But the Ninth Circuit has categorized substantive communications as discussions of legal consequences flowing from asserted facts, as allegations of misconduct, or as criticisms of the parties or their arguments. And all of those are included in this ex parte communication here. Regarding the various legal consequences flowing from asserted facts, the most obvious one being whether the first to file rule applies and whether it's appropriate to defer jurisdiction. The issue here is that the first to file rule, despite its namesake, is not a rigid or mechanical rule. It requires judges to weigh all of the facts of the case and determine whether the purpose of the rule is served by deferring jurisdiction. The district court here initially had indicated to the California court that it was inclined to defer jurisdiction, but only upon receiving confirmation from the California court that, yes, I think that's the proper course of action. And yes, I think we're on the same page here, that the district court ultimately dismissed the case outright. And besides the first to file issue, the district court here had also discussed whether service had been properly effectuated in this matter, which happens to be another consideration in applying the first to file rule. The district court here initially had told Mr. Messi that he had effectuated proper service on Vanessa. And then during this telephone conference, the California court indicated that based on his record, that service in Nevada may not have been properly effectuated. And then in the minute order dismissing this case, the district court states that service had not been properly effectuated in this matter. So the district court should have given Mr. Messi at least an opportunity to address that fact as well, given the back and forth. But beyond legal conclusions flowing from asserted facts, there was also an allegation of misconduct here that the district court made about Mr. Messi. In particular, the district court stated, quote, just because he's dodging service certainly doesn't get him off the hook in your state. This is certainly something that Mr. Messi should have been given the opportunity to address, particularly if the district court had intended to defer jurisdiction to this judge that it had made this allegation to. And beyond that, I think that's where this analysis comes down to about whether this ex parte communication was prejudicial. You're right that if it did contain merely procedural information, the Ninth Circuit has said that it's less likely that it would be prejudicial. But when it has, when the communication has a substantive nature to it, which, as an aside, the Nevada Code of Judicial Conduct prohibits outright, then the Ninth Circuit has said it is much more likely to be prejudicial.
Ms. Glantz, just briefly, if the court had determined that perhaps, or at least there was an issue about whether it was a first to file in California, should the court have stayed the action? I mean, would that have been more proper than the outright dismissal? One, that question, and then two, what do we make of the fact that Mr. Messi filed his appeal before the written order was in place, and is that something we need to be with at this point?
Absolutely. So to address your first point, The case absolutely, at a minimum, should have been stayed if the rule was going to be applied at all. The Ninth Circuit has said that when the second when the first filed case presents a likelihood of dismissal, that the case should be stayed rather than dismissed. And this makes sense when you consider the purpose of the first to file rule, which is to promote efficiency. You don't want parties to file in one jurisdiction, have the second filed action dismissed in another jurisdiction. You go to the first filed action, have that case dismissed, the parties then have to go back to the second filed jurisdiction, refile the case, and start from square one, despite how far along they might have been in that matter, which is another consideration of the first to file rule, is how far along the cases are. And to your second point regarding the final order. So there was ultimately a final order in this matter, and there is the Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure do provide for this. It states that the court can apply the final order to it. I forget the appellate rule, but it's cited in the briefs. So with that, if your honors do not have any more questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from the court in Las Vegas or Reno? Okay, hearing none, we'll, counsel, you may proceed on behalf of the respondent. Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Associate Chief Justice Gibbons, Justice Stiglitz, and Justice Silver. My name is Jill Ginkonko. I am counsel for Respondent Vanessa Messi. And as this court is aware, Respondent Vanessa Messi takes no position on the issues presented for this honorable court. However, if the court finds that the Nevada District Court erred by not giving Eric Messi notice and an opportunity for a hearing before dismissing a case, Vanessa maintains that the error was harmless, as the first to file rule nonetheless applies and California has jurisdiction over the case. Under the first to file rule, as this court is aware, sound judicial administration would indicate that when two identical actions are filed in courts of simultaneous jurisdiction, the court that first acquired jurisdiction should try the lawsuit, and no purpose would be served by proceeding with a second lawsuit. The two factors that...
Aren't there significant factual issues about whether jurisdiction was going to be proper in California?
Yes, there are some factual issues that we should address. With regard to California Family Code 2320, which was cited in appellant's response brief, under California Family Code 2320, a judgment of dissolution of marriage may not be entered unless one of the parties to the marriage has been a resident of this state, California, for 6 months, and of the county in which the proceeding is filed for the 3 months preceding the filing of the petition. Now, as this court is aware, residency is synonymous with domicile, and
Ginkonko, but isn't that something that the district court should make factual findings in the first instance? Isn't this court ill-equipped to make that type of finding based on this record?
I believe, the California court would be the correct court to make that finding. I don't find the California court would be ill-equipped to determine that.
Okay.
What I'm saying, I guess, is
you've said this is harmless error by our district court just dismissing it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. How do we find harmless error based on the facts on this record? We find that she should have had a hearing on this. Isn't it best that the district court make those findings that you're talking about?
Well, the reason Vanessa maintains that it was harmless error is because, but for the alleged error, a different result might have been reached, which Eric Messi cannot show. Your Honors, nothing changes the fact that Vanessa Messi did file her case in California first on January 23rd. Judicial efficiency is best served if the case remains in California for the following reasons. Vanessa successfully did file in California. Judge Franco, the judge presiding over the case, was familiar with the facts of the case and familiar with the parties, specifically Vanessa's difficulty in serving Eric and the circumstances surrounding the temporary restraining order, which also was filed in that same court. Judicial efficiency won't be best served in Nevada District Court. The reason is Eric's divorce decree, as you can see in the record, was stricken numerous times by the Nevada District Court due to procedural deficiencies, and also service was not proper on Vanessa's bankruptcy attorney.
Wouldn't it have been more proper for the court to just stay the action? Because if the position is California ultimately is not going to have jurisdiction. She didn't live there 6 months as a resident. I think that's what Mr. Messi's argument is. What else, can he do? Why should he have to go litigate in a foreign forum without kind of reserving his rights here in their state of residence, putting a hold button on it as opposed to just dismissing outright for them, if he is successful in California, to have to come back and refile?
Well, Vanessa's argument is that there is jurisdiction in California. She was a resident. Being present in Las Vegas from the dates, I believe, are November 29 to the December 30th, does not equate her to being a resident of Nevada. Before and after, Vanessa was residing in Santa Clara. So, again, the argument that counsel says where the first filed action presents a likelihood of dismissal, the second filed action should be stayed. However, we argue that the California case does not present a likelihood of dismissal.
And that's based upon the ex parte conversation that the Nevada judge had with Judge Franco in California, correct?
Well, that and also that she was not a resident of Nevada.
Right, but that's a factual legal determination that's got to be made. That's still, hotly contested. So, maybe talking then about the phone call, because this is all about whether Mr. Messi is getting to participate in this process in a way that satisfies due process. And so a lot of what you're talking about in support of your position seems to be stemming from this ex parte communication. So tell me about that.
Well, sorry, can you repeat your question?
Not a chance, because you're talking and you ask the questions, but the question is really your argument is conflated, probably properly, with information that was given to the district court in Nevada in the ex parte telephone call, where clearly there was some factual information exchange and those type of things. So the question we're being asked to determine is, was Mr. Messi given an opportunity to participate in these hearings and be heard? There's a due process aspect, and then whether the court really was proper for the court to ultimately dismiss. So if you can kind of address that, because if the call's not proper, then where are we?
Your Honor, we don't dispute that his due process, he wasn't given due process, as he wasn't given an opportunity to be heard before dismissing his case. But again, we just argue that it's harmless error. Also, I do want to touch upon the California case. I did also check the docket in that case, and at this time, it was shown that Eric was served in the California case properly on March 26. Eric has retained counsel twice in California, and Eric is actively participating, which goes against his assertion that it's not possible for him to litigate in California due to his health issues.
But the fact, I'm going to back about two layers up, though. The fact that he is litigating in California still doesn't mean that California is has jurisdiction over the divorce, right? I mean, that's still to be determined whether she's a resident. I mean, the fact that now he's got a forum that he's fighting in doesn't mean that ultimately that's going to end up being the correct form, or am I missing something?
I concede to that. That is correct. That still is a factual issue that does have to be addressed.
What case stands for the proposition? You said you would admit that he wasn't given due process, but it's harmless error. What case stands for that proposition? You're not given due process, that would be harmless. I mean, that would be the antithesis this of harmless error, right?
Yes. I cited Wyeth v. Rowett and Countrywide Home Loans that to determine whether an error is prejudicial, the movement must show that the error affects the party's substantial rights so that, but for the alleged error, a different result might have reasonably been reached. And under Wyeth, when an error is harmless, reversal is not warranted. And I've also cited Drayton v. Scallon in my brief. So, Your Honors, to sum up my argument, Vanessa requests this court to affirm Nevada District Court's dismissal order as reversal and remand would prove futile. It would be a waste of judicial resources, time and expense, unnecessary legal proceedings, and parties' legal fees and costs. For the reasons I've mentioned before, the all interests are best served if the case remains in California, and again, for the reasons that the California case has proceeded, and Eric is actively participating in that case.
But Ms. Duhanco, wouldn't the practical effect of a reversal here and a remand would be likely that the court would just stay the Nevada action? Isn't that what would properly happen if the dismissal was reversed? The court would stay the Nevada action while California shakes out. So is that, how big an imposition would that be on this is messy? As opposed to letting the dismissal stand, and then if we were to find that California was not a proper forum, having to then reserve everybody, start a lawsuit again in Nevada. Just spitballing here, just trying to see.
Well, Vanessa is then having to deal with two different cases, so as is Eric. Vanessa is still dealing with her health issues and is unable to travel and litigate in Nevada, whereas in this case, Eric has been able to litigate in California so far.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, did you have anything else you wanted to argue? You still have about 4 minutes left, or are you finished?
No,
Your Honors. I have finished the points that I had wanted to make. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Glantz?
Okay, a couple brief points here on rebuttal. Vanessa concedes that there was due process violations here, that Mr. Messi was not given adequate notice or the opportunity to be heard. But she contends that it was harmless error, essentially because she contends that that underlying decision is correct. But whether or not the decision is correct is not the standard for harmless error. And even if it were the standard, we think that the district court did not have the correct result in dismissing the case outright. So addressing that harmless error component, this court has said that an error is prejudicial when, but for the alleged error, a different result might reasonably have been reached. The inquiry is fact-dependent and requires the court to evaluate the error in light of the entire record. The problem here, as Justice Stiglitz noted, is that any arguments or evidence that go towards whether the first-to-file rule apply or go to any of those factual contentions that the district court should have considered to determine whether to defer jurisdiction all come from due process violations. Any of the arguments or evidence that the district court relied on from that ex parte communication, even if that was considered harmless error, you still have the issue that Mr. Messi was not given adequate notice or the opportunity to be heard on this issue. And even if that was harmless error, that the district court did not give Mr. Messi an adequate notice or the opportunity to be heard on that issue, you still have the issue of the ex parte communication. And I think both of these errors kind of compound on each other and make that hurdle a little bit higher to get over to say that this was harmless error. And in fact, when you look at the record in this matter, you can see that the district court does kind of waver in her determination. Initially, when this ex parte communication was initiated, the district court had said that she was inclined to defer jurisdiction, but it's only upon receiving that confirmation from the court that, yes, we're on the same page, and yes, this is appropriate, that she ultimately and immediately dismisses the case. And you also see that wavering a little bit with regards to service. As I mentioned earlier, initially the district court had said that Mr. Messy had effectuated proper service, but then in the minute order that followed this telephone conference, the district court said that neither party had effectuated proper service in this matter. You see it again in the way the district court characterizes this telephone conference. Initially, the district court had sent a memorandum to Mr. Messy saying that it was going to set up a telephone conference. But then in the minute order and the transcript, the district court labels this as a hearing. And then later in the final order, the district court labels this as a UCC-JEA conference, which I touched on with Justice Silver earlier, that doesn't apply here because there are no children involved. So when you look at all of this, I think it's difficult to say that it was not at the very least reasonable that the district court might have come to a different conclusion. And in fact, if Mr. Messy had been given the opportunity to present argument on the first to file rule, a different result may also have reasonably been reached. As Justice Stiglitz mentioned, there was no jurisdiction in the first filed case. The district court should have at least considered that and needed to at least consider that to determine whether or not it was likely to be dismissed in the first filed case. And as I mentioned earlier, the first filed rule, despite its namesake, is not a rigid or mechanical rule. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it must be applied with discretion appropriate for disciplined and experienced judges, and it requires judges to weigh all of the facts of the case to determine whether or not the rule's purpose in promoting efficiency would be served by deferring jurisdiction. As Justice Stiglitz noted, there are factual issues that were never addressed between the parties because Mr. Messy was not given that opportunity to be heard. And if the district court had been able to adequately consider a record in full and that had proper briefing on this matter or heard the parties, the district court might reasonably have come to a different conclusion. So because of that, Eric is not asking this court to make a determination on the merits today. Rather, he simply asked this court to send this matter back to the district court for a proper hearing so that he may address that the first to file rule does not apply here. And if it does, outright dismissal is not proper based on the issue of jurisdiction. He also asked that this court remand the matter so that he can have that opportunity to address those contentions in that ex parte communication. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Clance. Thank both counsel. I want to compliment both of you. Excellent arguments, excellent briefs. It was really well done, and we appreciate both your firms accepting pro bono cases because, boy, these two clients of yours got excellent representation mm-hmm. from both of you, and so you're a credit to the program, and thank you so much in doing so. And at this time, we'll take the case under submission, and we'll be in recess till 11.